But right now, it's time for Oh, the Humanities, taking a look at humanities scholarship research and events on campus with Max Orr, who heads up the Carolina Public Humanities at UNC. Humanities.unc.edu is the website, and Carolina Public Humanities has a really big event coming up later on this week and weekend, which we'll be talking about in just a couple of minutes. But Max, thanks for being with us today. How are you?
Always my pleasure to be here, despite the yellow snow on everybody and whatnot.
It's just foggy with pollen out there, isn't it?
It's foggy with pollen. Yeah. It looks beautiful. The flowers look beautiful, but then you look on the ground and it's just yellow. You know,
that's the pollen that made it to the ground as opposed to landing on everyone's cars.
Or
which
in their lungs.
Yeah, or in their lungs.
So.
Yeah, exactly.
And it'll all wash away tonight, supposedly.
Imagine having a radio show where you have to come in and talk for 4 hours straight while just every time the microphone is off, you're sneezing and blowing your nose.
I thought lecturing for an hour was really difficult.
It is.
Now I feel bad for you.
Yeah.
I do. So, as always, I bring you gifts related to today. Today is April 8th, and on April 8th in 1946, Electricité de France, the French public electricity company, was founded. This is the world's largest public utility company, and is formed after a wholesale nationalization of the sector, including producers, transporters, and distributors. And it's still around. It's the fifth largest of all electrical companies,
wow,
but the largest public utility. And also on April 8th in 1959, the Organization of American States formed the Inter-American Development Bank. And this was sort of during the height of pushing import substitution and trying to encourage Latin American countries to develop their industrial sectors and whatnot as part of an international development movement, modernization movement. These are they have some ramifications, these types of developments.
Energy and
development.
The use thereof,
and production.
Yes.
And so it is a real pleasure to welcome Don Adu. He is the Southeast Regional Director of the Citizens Climate Lobby. And Don was going to be one of the respondents to Philip Kitcher, who's coming down on Friday. You mentioned our big event is the April 12th Adams Symposium in the Public Humanities. And Philip Kitcher is the John Dewey Professor of Philosophy from Columbia. And he's coming down to give a talk on Friday night called Why is Climate Change So Hard to... Oh, I'm going to get the name wrong. Why is climate...
So difficult to address.
So thank you. I knew I said it.
It's not just hard, it's difficult.
Yes, it's difficult. So difficult to address or stop. And so that's on Friday night at 5:30 at the Wilson Library. But on the next day, out at the Center for School Leadership Development, which is by the Friday Center, also free and open to the public, we have six respondents, everyone from a professor of law to a biologist.
Philosopher,
yeah. Yep. And one of our Adams Fellows is going to be doing... But it's also important to get people who are working in this field, and that's why we had Don Adu come to talk about, you know, how it is that you handle this issue, what's so difficult to address or stop. Right now, you're working on it. So, Don, why is it so difficult?
Don, thanks for being with us here.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for having me. So, one of the things when it comes to climate change is I think there's an underlying fear that a lot of folks deal with, either a fear of what it's going to mean for the next generation or what it's going to mean for folks now, or kind of on the other side, does it mean a loss of a way of life or a loss for folks who, you know, who work in the oil industry or the oil and gas industry, and so they're concerned about their future and their family. So I think there's really a rooted fear in this that we need to address, and we need to be able to listen and hear folks before we can have really a conversation about the science.
And it seems like in terms of the conversation, as I've heard, the argument that's been the most salient in terms of convincing people that this is something that we need to do something about and we need to do something about it now is addressing that fear by saying that change is inevitable, that the current way of life that we have, something is going to change one way or the other that's going to force us out of that in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely. As a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby, I have the opportunity to talk to a lot of different people all across the Southeast. And, you know, we're looking at, like, these two hurricanes that we've just experienced, though, with 500-year flood events back-to-back in North Carolina. That means that people who have lived on the coast for generations, whose houses have never flooded before, are now flooding. And so it's hitting folks directly. There was a woman who came to the Durham City Council working session a couple of days ago, and she talked about how her house is now starting to flood more and more frequently. And so it's impacting folks at home. It's not something that's far off, and kind of having that conversation and saying, this is something that is something we can do now, and take out the fear, because a lot of times there's fear in the solution. Mm-hmm. And we're supporting a bill in Congress right now, a bipartisan bill called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. That's H.R. 763 for my wonks out there. So what we would do is put a price on fossil fuels that returns revenue back to folks. And in doing so, we'd create 2.1 million jobs over 10 years. We'd reduce emissions 40% over 12 years. We'd save 60,000 premature deaths over that same period. And it's bipartisan and revenue neutral. So it really gives us an opportunity to have that conversation.
Is that cap and trade? Is it similar to?
It's kind of like cap and trade, except what this would do is put a fee on fossil fuels, on oil, gas, natural gas, coal. And that fee would go up every year. And the fossil fuel companies, the ExxonMobil's, Shell Energies, they're the ones that are going to pay this fee. Mm-hmm. That revenue is going to go into a specific account. And then from that account, we will return that revenue evenly to every American in the form of a monthly check. So you would get your carbon dividend check every month.
I like that.
Yeah.
And this is an incentive for those fossil fuel companies to be switching to alternative energy sources, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So we go ahead.
I was just interesting about what you were saying earlier about this fear, and what we're really talking about is trying to transform fear into hope. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's interesting about that is it seems like when you attack the problem so broadly without sort of this, and this idea there's an actual dividend that comes out, this is going to redound in your wallet, you know? But you had said something earlier when we were talking about how you can also get at this by identifying other problems that people have, a sort of intersectionality of, we might not identify this as a climate change things, but a climate change related problem that we're having, and that language. So how do you do that? How do you, because if I feel like if you jump at someone and just say, climate change, here's my big proposal, and, you know, buy it, what strategies and techniques do you use to kind of get other angles at approaching the problem?
Absolutely. So the first thing we want to do is we got to be hearing folks. And that means asking them, you know, say, well, I work on climate change and I've got a solution that I think is pretty good. And then say, you know, what are your thoughts on climate change? And if somebody comes back and says, well, climate change isn't real, I don't believe that science. Okay, great. We can throw all the science at them we want. They're never going to hear it. Mm-hmm. It's really important that we then ask, tell me more. Tell me why you don't believe the science. Because I found it's never that they don't actually believe the science. It's they feared the solution. They fear what it means for them and their family. There's some underlying distrust of government, something in there that we've got to get to, that we've got to have that conversation to. And once we identify that fear and have that conversation, then we can move on to a solutions conversation and a hopeful conversation.
That's a really good way of just doing political discourse in general, right? Rather than saying no, just continue to say yes until you get to that common ground.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's interesting that the humanities, people don't always think, well, I'm going to tackle this incredibly technical, political, and scientific problem through the humanities. But, you know, listen to the words we're using. We're talking about, effective conversation. We're talking about working with people's emotions and understanding that emotions cloud rationality. And these are all philosophical topics. And in particular, Maynard Adams, who this is all in honor of, I had mentioned earlier, he was one of the key ideas he had was that, you know, feelings and emotions are perhaps the most important way that we can get at some moral truths and moral values. And so we're entering into this conversation at a very humanistic level, but the ramifications are very practical.
Mm-hmm. How have you seen the debate change in the last few years?
It's been amazing. I've been doing this for almost 10 years, and the change in the last 2 years has been phenomenal. First is opening the door for this to be a bipartisan issue. Mm-hmm. This is a bridge issue, not a wedge issue. And making sure that we're engaging both sides of the aisle. A lot of folks, wrote off the right, and that this wasn't even something we could talk about. And we've consistently been meeting with members of Congress on both sides and listening to them. You know, it's just like talking to your neighbor. When you go into your member of Congress, you got to be listening to what they care about. My background is in hard science, and when I first got involved with this work, I thought, well, I'll just go meet with my member of Congress, I'll show them the data, and they'll do the right thing. And I've learned a lot since then.
That's why politics works. Everybody's a rational
actor,
and they just, you just explain it, they're going to go.
Until it turns out that everyone's a rational actor in six different ways, unfortunately. You're very excited about this issue. What is it that got you excited about it in the first place?
I see it as the overriding issue. There, when we look at everything that it's impacting our way of life, from uh, the the racial gap, the equity gap, the economic gap, all of it ties back to the environment. If we're not creating a stable environment, we don't have a way to move forward so that we have clean water, clean air, and ability for people to just live healthy lives, then everything else becomes much more challenging. We look at immigration, which is obviously a hot topic right now. We know that a prolonged multi-year drought in Syria was a major driver for that war that has now created a humanitarian crisis and driven immigration and now hardline policies in Europe.
Oh, I mean, spoiler alert, because the conversation that we're going to air at 5:30 was pre-recorded earlier today, so I can tell you 100% that Sarah Bermeo from Duke makes a very, very strong case that the crisis at our border right now is a product of climate change causing a drought that's lasted for years in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala.
What's interesting about that, I think, is this sort of a pessimistic optimism, is that as people become impacted by climate change, like, you know, it seems like one thing, oh, there are some islands out in the South Pacific or in the Indian Ocean, these nations, and whatever. And even, you know, there's a drought in Syria. But as things begin to affect people, like, do we notice that everybody maybe 10 years ago would say, if they lived in a hurricane zone, yeah, we're used to hurricanes. This is a normal part of life. But then when you get 5 and, you know, in 8 years that are so devastating in places like Lumberton or New Bern, that this is, you know, it's, I hate to say it, but this sort of, when these bad events begin to affect us, it gives us an opening maybe that we can be optimistic about.
You bet. Absolutely. And we're seeing it now. Look at the flooding that just took place in the Midwest. It's like the vast majority of the places that were affected, I mean, that's deep red territory. And so when people start to feel it, it really makes a big difference. And so we've seen that with members of Congress and the general public.
And it's about feeling it in a particular way, because I've seen, and I've got so many family members up in Michigan, and I know you've seen the same kind of world climate maps that I've seen, where it's just everything is hotter, hotter, hotter all across the entire globe, except for the upper Midwest, which because of climate change is colder, just because that's the way that it's happened. And it's a hard thing to convince people that the world is warming when they're feeling so much colder.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's so important. I don't like the term global warming, because it's really a misnomer. You know, climate change is hotter hots, colder colds, wetter wets, drier dries. That's what it means. And so that has massive implications for our water supply.
And not evenly dispersed either, right?
Exactly.
So that also makes it tough to have sort of a universal perspective on it. Where I am, it's just dry. Where I am, it's just wetter. Or where I am, it's hotter or colder.
And it can also be hyper-local. One of the things I've started doing is I've got a rain gauge in my house, and I compare my rain gauge with what the RDU totals are. And they are significantly different. I live in South Durham. So, you know, if you want to try that at home, give it a shot. You'll see that your microclimate is actually very unique. And will become more extreme over time.
More so than before.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Speaking with Donna Dew, Max Orr, we're talking about climate change. We're talking about it ahead of the ADAM Symposium, which is coming up Friday at 5:30 at the Wilson Library. Philip Kitcher of Columbia University is going to be delivering the keynote address, Why is Climate Change So Difficult to Address or Stop? Panel discussion is going to be Saturday at 9 a.m. At the Center for School Leadership Development, which is right by the Friday Center. Who is going to talk about what? What is your talk going to focus on, Don?
My talk is going to focus specifically on how do we do this type of communication, how do we create the political will for climate change, and why climate change ties everything together.
And Max, you mentioned philosophers, biologists,
so
and a whole bunch of people.
Luke Bovins is a fantastic philosopher. He's going to be applying some of the famous Nash from Beautiful Mind, some of that game theory, and talking about how it is that how do you create these sort of cultural shifts that can pull people along, because you're not going to win this rational battle, but cultural changes can happen that can pull people along, and they feel that sort of pressure. We have Maria Sebasta Kennedy from the law school, who's going to be talking about, you know, the people who don't have a voice. We keep talking about, how do we talk about climate change? What about communities of color? What about places where people don't have a voice? And what can the legal system do through things like children's trust cases, in which children can bring entire cases against states and against municipalities to lobby for climate change, for addressing climate change? We have Lita Van Doren, who's from the Environmental Department. She's talking about energy and technology. She's going to be our optimist, talking about some, you know, I love this. It's, we have a sort of science fiction. I came up with this one today. Science fiction in the future. It's not even that fictional, that it's going to be very drastic. And I say she's looking at science fixing. And we'll talk about, you know, if we had the political will, there are things that we can do scientifically to address it. Our graduate student, our Adams Fellow, Alicia Barranco Lopez, is going to be talking about a psychological resistance to dealing with uncomfortable topics and uncomfortable subjects, and how that is a chain on sort of personal behavior. And, you know, I don't want to change because it makes, and like you said, I mean, people aren't going to change their way of life. It makes them uncomfortable. They might rationally understand it, but they don't like to be in situations where mm-hmm. they're uncomfortable. And finally, we have a biologist, Joel Kingsolver, who has done amazing work on his own, seeing climate change in the field and his field studies. But he's going to be looking at, you know, why was it that Rachel Carson, one person, could have such a massive impact on the environment in the 1960s and 70s, and yet when you impanel from all over the world, the IPCC, there's a gigantic panel of climate scientists, and you impanel all of them, that they can't have this effect. And what is it about, you know, the messengers? And it sort of, again, ties down to our personal experiences. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was about, there are no birds in the trees in my beautiful backyard anymore, right? And that's but panels of scientists and governments and whatnot are not going to be effective. So we have a lot of perspectives. And of course, Philip Kitcher will be able to respond to everyone. And most important, as you know, is dialogue and reflection. So community members on that Saturday morning will have plenty of opportunity to ask questions and give comments.
That's going to be really cool. Again, humanities.unc.edu for more info. We got to wrap up. Don, I'll let you have the last word. Something that people don't know about climate change that they ought to.
That there is a lot of hope and that we can pass a national solution to this problem.
Again, humanities.unc.edu for more on Carolina Public Humanities and the Adams Symposium. If people want more on the Citizens Climate Lobby, where can they go?
CitizensClimateLobby.org.
Very easy. Again, Donadue's going to be at the Adams Symposium on Saturday, 9 a.m., Center for School Leadership Development. The keynote address Friday at 5:30 at Wilson Library. Don, Max, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.